Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever it is you are listening. This is Dan Turchin, host of AI and the Future of Work, and the CEO of Insight Finder, the AI-first platform for IT operations. Very excited about today's show. As you know, we've been speaking with investors lately who have been writing checks to ambitious entrepreneurs to fund the future of work. Well, we've heard some amazing founding stories recently about, say, HashiCorp, about Airbnb, TubeMogul, about how these companies grew from scrappy startups to category leaders. Well, every once in a while, we get insights from the C-suite, from companies that have already achieved success at scale and frankly changed the world. Today's guest is one of those. Wendy Pfeiffer is a high-profile Silicon Valley CIO who currently leads IT at Nutanix. Nutanix, if you're not familiar with it, is a $6 billion software-defined storage company that got its start in 2009 and has since grown to over 6,000 employees. I met Wendy and her team years back and was just amazed by how comfortable everyone was with the CIO in the room. We cracked jokes, we laughed, people were leaning back in their chairs. I didn't know that any of that was allowed in the halls of power at a tech giant. That's the Wendy I know, a CIO with a heart, who recently tweeted about a sheep that grew such a thick coat of fur that it couldn't be attacked by wolves. And Wendy's comment was, it turns out you can be soft and fluffy and still survive. Without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Nutanix CIO, director at high-profile companies like Qualys, and mentor to young engineers, Wendy Pfeiffer, who, by the way, you must go follow on Twitter at Wendy M. Pfeiffer, P-F-E-I-F-F-E-R. Wendy, welcome to the podcast. Why don't you share a little bit about your background and how you got into this space?
Dan, what a great introduction. I can't even stand it. I sound amazing. Thank you so much. Let's see. My background, I am a lover of gadgets and technology and enabling things to work with technology. I am definitely an IT person. In IT, we love the confluence of technology and operations in service of people and business. And so I live at that intersection and genuinely enjoy that. I can tell you that my path was not straight. My very first job was working at NASA Ames Research Center in the space biology research program. And I came to Nutanix by way of a few tech companies. The one just before Nutanix was GoPro, where I was the CIO. And I can tell you that most companies I've joined certainly for the opportunity, but also because I really, really love the tech. I loved those GoPro action cameras. I love Nutanix technology, and I just can't stay away. I just like to be able to tinker with it and be in the midst of the playground. And so that's gotten me to here. I'm married to a musician. I have two teenage kids, and we've all been sheltering in place at home together for the last year. So if anyone has a spare room, I am totally available.
Well, Wendy, before we started recording, we were talking about leadership and what qualities define a great leader. I'd love to hear from you. What is your leadership style? And maybe equally important, how has it changed over the last year?
I am a very inclusive leader. I tend to have leaders whom I both know and have also worked with to develop over time. My senior leadership team tend to be people who I've worked with in the past. I like a very eclectic team. Recently, I had one of my leaders tell me that, man, this is the most diverse and challenging leadership team that I've been a part of. So I like different opinions. I like people with different viewpoints. I'm very interested in having a global leadership team. So some of my key leaders are in countries and regions outside of the US. And I think that leadership, particularly in a team, should be challenging. It should push the boundaries. It should be difficult sometimes to make the right decisions and find ways of moving forward together. And I think there we should have the ability to be honest and transparent. But all of those things are tempered with grace. All of those things are tempered with kindness and forgiveness. And so I think it's possible for us as, you know, evolved human beings to hold more than one thought in our heads at the same time, to be directive, ambitious, to care about money, to care about position, to take territory, to hire and fire decisively, to make sure that we're, following the rules, but at the same time, take big chances, and to do those things in concert with other human beings in a way that is powerful, yet respectful. And I think it's possible to engage in a mix of modes and be perfectly successful and be happy as well.
I love that adjective grace to describe leadership. Yeah. And I know from working with members of your team that that is an accurate description of how you lead by example.
Thank you. Yeah, this is, I'm kind of simple-minded about a few things. Every year I pick a theme word for me. This is my year of grace. I'm trying to show that grace to myself and to my team members and to my family and also to society that I'm a part of. I don't believe in wallowing in the past. I don't believe in living in our differences. And I can't figure out a way to move forward and to move forward powerfully and successfully unless I'm moving forward in grace. And so I think for me that's a huge theme this year. Grace is a condition in which we're open to others. It's not deserved by me. It's not deserved by others, but it's massively enabling and empowering. And ultimately, if the future is going to not suck, then we have to actively engage in something akin to graceful, gracious living.
How do you gracefully lead a remote team?
Well, the first thing that I have to do is to be empathetic. And one thing that working remotely has helped all of us is to have empathy for the true experience of a worker or a student or a person who is connecting with one of our hubs from a remote location. And so that's part of it. But there are some really, there's tons of interesting things to talk about here. I'll focus on just one that I've learned. I have learned as a leader, first of all, that I need to provide absolute clarity. Clarity is incredibly, incredibly important. So when I have folks all over the world in all different time zones and all different locations, I can't rely on them to get the meaning of my words. I have to be precise. I have to be hierarchical at times, directive at times, which is a little more focused than I would normally be. I believe in allowing people to find their own ways to do things, but that's difficult at some scale when we're all in our individual swim lanes. And so creating the structure and the hierarchy and the clarity of purpose, of priority is very important. On the other hand, then there has to be some way of people working asynchronously, autonomously. And so within the same framework of control and clarity and structure, there needs to be a framework of autonomy and self-direction and creativity and so on. And so at Nutanix in IT, over the last year or so, we've implemented a full agile iterative working model. We have centralized information radiators that allow us to understand the requirements, the priorities, the work to be done, and so on. But then individual team members in our 24/7 global team are able to connect with the work to be done asynchronously, understand how that work is to be done and how to connect to the other other folks in the teams. And then in their own time zone, with their own schedule constraints, they're able to do that work and connect back to the center. And so that takes architecture, it takes leadership, it also takes trust.
The role of the CIO is notorious for having the shortest tenure in the C-suite. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, there's the conventional wisdom, and then there's the water cooler wisdom. So the conventional wisdom has to do with any position in the C-suite in a publicly traded company. And that is, ultimately, those of us in the C-suite, we serve at the will of the board of directors. And so as business conditions change, we are given financial targets, we're given operational targets that we need to meet. If we meet those targets, if we're successful, and if we're very successful and continue to meet those targets, then in general terms, we keep our jobs. But on the other hand, if we're not as successful, or if there's a change of direction, or if there's a change of leadership, then we tend to be the first people to sort of go. And so if you look at the tenure of any CMO, CHRO, whatever, in the C-suite, tends to be somewhere between 3 to 5 years. Now, CIOs, on the other side of the spectrum, there are CIOs who are true members of the C-suite, and there are those who kind of get the title because they're the top person in charge of technology. When a CIO is the top person in charge of technology and is not doing a good job connecting to the financial requirements of their role, those CIOs tend not to last. There are some CIOs who are sort of blind to the commercial aspects of the businesses they serve. And instead, they're very concerned about technology. They may be someone who declares, well, we're a pick a vendor shop, or we've standardized on this, or our policy for, access or employee enablement is that. And so those rigid policies, those focuses on particular technologies, they tend to not serve publicly traded companies that need to scale. And so companies need to find people in charge of technology who understand how to use it in service of business. And what seems to me to happen as I observe the whole group of us is that there are some CIOs who understand that. And those folks tend to have rich and satisfying careers. And there are others who tend to be relatively short-lived.
So I described you as a technologist with a heart. Talk to us about one of your role models.
I have a range of role models. I'm really interested in Eleanor Roosevelt. So the cool thing about Eleanor Roosevelt, from my perspective, is that she had this notion that even though people sort of discounted her, they saw her in light of her husband, that as long as she didn't care who got the credit, as long as she didn't care, how she was personally perceived, she actually had a pretty ridiculously large span of control and capability to really affect change. And so she's the mother of so many social programs and capabilities in our society today, because she simply, while everyone else was looking the other way, began to execute and had a point of view. And so I love some of the stories of the public works programs that she set up and the homeless shelters that she created, the opportunities for women, for people from disadvantaged backgrounds, differently abled folks. She did so much work because she was satisfied to do a lot of that work in stealth mode, and because people really never saw her coming. And so if you think about what our role is as leaders, and I think about my role, I'm a fairly aggressive person. I would just as soon punch you in the face as have a long drawn out conversation with you. But I've learned that that doesn't scale. That's not effective. And so it's actually okay as a leader to be very, very conscious of the chess game and to be actively playing that chess game. And it's perfectly okay to give a little in the face-to-face negotiation because you have a secret plot to destroy the other person, from the side. It's okay to have schemes. It's okay to think politically. It's okay to be objective driven. Of course, we want to be ethical. We want to be transparent. We want to be kind-hearted. But at the same time, it's okay to be playing the chess game and to be thinking four or five moves in advance. And this is one of the things that the lessons that I took from Eleanor Roosevelt is she was always playing the chess game. She was aware of her unfair advantage being the wife of the president and the unfair access that she had as compared to other women in her position. And she used it. She used her unfair advantage. I love that model. There's a lot of content there as well. Another person I really admire is John Madden. And John Madden is the guy who sort of taught me about this unfair advantage principle. And I've used it throughout my career.
Maybe you have an RV to go with the philosophy like John Madden.
I would love that. I mean, this is a cool, so I love this principle, and it's something that I don't know if maybe it's a male and female thing. I really don't know, but I can tell you as a, the way I was raised, I was taught that, you know, look, if you walk onto the playground and there's, you know, and you're 5'10" and there's a little, you know, there's a little kid who's three feet tall and they, you know, challenge you to a basketball game. Like, you've got an unfair advantage. You're like double their height, right? And so what you do, I was taught, is you kind of like dumb down your game for the kid, you know, like you play nice, right? And so that's like awesome for basketball courts and kids. But in life, you are not required to do that. And John Madden gives a lot of great speeches about this, and, you know, just to kind of take the analogy out there. You're in the playoffs. It's like the Warriors. They show up, and they've got, you know, back in the day, you know, they've got Klay, they've got Steph, they've got, you know, Kevin Durant, Draymond, all the guys, right? And the other team, like stomach flu, has you know, wiped out the team, and they have all their B players. You know, what does Steve Kerr do? Does Steve Kerr go like, well, oh my gosh, those poor, it's the playoffs. Those poor guys, they have the flu. You know, Kevin, Steph, just why don't you stay on the bench? Because it would be an unfair, no. That unfair advantage is not accidental. It's not an act of God. It's bought and paid for. It's been honed in practices. It's been developed. And so it's immoral, it's unethical to walk onto the court and leave that advantage on the bench. That's not what you're getting paid for. And the same is true in life and in showing up as a leader. If you have some sort of unfair advantage, it's not like the playground. This is life. And so you show up and you bring that to the table to the good of your company or your cause or even your family, whatever is motivating you. You bring that unfair advantage, you use it, and don't worry. Many times in your life, someone else will show up with an unfair advantage against you, and it balances out in the end.
So we're recording this in March 2021. It's the first week of Women's History Month. Let's talk about maybe an unfair disadvantage. How would you describe the current state of access to leadership roles in high tech for women?
I think the statistics are terrible. I think our understanding of jobs and work and how women and men stereotypically connect to those jobs and work is flawed. And I'm 30 years into my career, And I will tell you that the percentages of women in senior leadership tech positions have not changed much. You know, it's still 18 to 25% like it was when I was starting 30 years ago. And so what does that mean? You know, should we keep trying to push water uphill with a fork? Should we, you know, like a lot of men say, should we lower our standards to let more women in? What is at the heart of this phenomenon? And my theories about that are, they differ from a lot of my peers. I believe, especially in tech, that's the field I know the most about. I believe that in tech, we have some characteristics of technical jobs that make them unattractive and unsustainable for women. And this, you know, there are always exceptions to this. I am an exception to this for sure. But just sort of going with the stereotypes, one of the things about women is that we're multi-threaded, we're multifaceted. We really are just acculturated, and even just the way that we think, we like doing multiple things in parallel. We have that capability. And so, you know, meanwhile, in general terms, men tend to be a little more single-threaded, a little more serial, first your socks, then your shoes. Do one thing at a time, do it well, get it done. If we think about how technology roles are constructed, technology roles tend to be very single-threaded. You have a software developer. Their job is to develop software. They're sitting in teams of software developers, each of them developing some part of the code. You have a systems engineer. They manage certain systems. Their job is only to manage systems. These kinds of jobs are soul-crushing. They're mind-numbing for women. For men, there's a pathway of achievement in these jobs, and you can move up the hierarchy. For women, there's a lot of recidivism, even in the women who make it through these focused technical degrees and then make it to those jobs. The jobs are not interesting, they're not engaging, and the future of that work is not as compelling for women. And so that intersects with another thing happening in society right now, which is Gen Z entering the workforce. Gen Z is the first fully digitally native generation, and they are also very identity neutral. It's not about who you know, it's about what you know. Reputation can be built and sort of, you know, underscored in virtual space with identity fluid. And so in that context, this notion of how men and women work and what roles we're in, that's going to be changing, because for Gen Z, there are very different notions of identity and how identity connects to reputation and capability and work. And so it's a perfect time to do this thing that Gen Z is already doing, which is change the roles and change the org structures and create multifaceted roles, multifaceted org structures. This age of COVID and remote work is accelerating that change. People are learning that they can connect to job opportunities and even multiple job opportunities in ways that make sense to them. They can mix their roles. And we're learning that we have to mix up the roles. It's unhealthy and untenable for a software developer to spend 10 hours a day alone at their desk writing code and never interacting with anyone else. Now we have an opportunity to change up roles, to have some time for interaction, some time for solo and focused work. These multi-moded roles are much better attuned to women who are technologists, but they are also marketers, designers, managers, writers, creators in and multiple levels. And so I think we ultimately, as our roles change, as the structure of our companies change, and as the nature of the workforce changes with the influx of Gen Z, we're going to find more women persisting in technology sectors, but in roles that are not traditionally previously tagged as pure tech.
So I have two daughters, school age, and you are a mentor, and or at least I know you have been a mentor for girls in tech. What do you tell my kids to make them feel like they're not systemically disadvantaged? You know, how do we empower them to pursue careers in tech, because they're just as entitled to have those jobs as anyone?
I struggle with that too. I'm a mom of a 15-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter. And I think that there will always be things that are unfair. There will always be disadvantages. Sometimes they're geographic or age or, financial. There's a lot of things in life that aren't fair. I mean, we learn that playing sports as well. And so I would say the most important thing that you can do for your daughters is to teach them how to move forward in the face of things that are unfair and uncomfortable. And this will do them in good stead, whether they face gender bias or some other kind of bias. I think that's the most important thing. And then for themselves, I find that we attract the sorts of people that we are. And so it's important to, first of all, show up as our genuine selves. And secondly, to be inclusive of others. And what's great about the generation that your daughters and my daughter and son belong to is that, again, it is that most inclusive generation. And so they may have to remake the norms of higher education. They may have to remake the norms of corporate America or geopolitics. They may have to remake those things because clearly the current norms are already outmoded and are already ineffective. And so maybe there's a heavy lift there. Maybe they'll have to try harder to work in the sorts of companies they'd like to work in, but they're certainly capable of it. And if they have that passion, they can do that. So that's what I'd say. Ultimately, build the skills of resilience. And then no matter what comes, whether it's gender bias or whether it's a global pandemic, they have the skills to hopefully survive, if not thrive through it.
Beautifully said. I'm going to play that back for my daughters, I think.
Awesome.
With attribution, of course.
Awesome.
So our kids are going to graduate into a very different world of work than you and I inherited. What do you think is going to change? Let's say 2025, 2030 even. What will be something that will be different about work that maybe today might seem like science fiction or, just fictitious?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love this topic. I think that in 5 years, the biggest thing we'll notice is that we really have a true blend of consumer technology and enterprise technology at work. We're seeing that during this pandemic. I'm talking to you from my gaming computer over public internet, using a corporate application, to do so. And so ultimately, we've sort of forever, put all the tech into the same, stew pot, and now it's percolating. The thing is, consumer tech is much cooler and much better than enterprise tech on every level, but particularly in a few areas that have to do with game design and game theory. Consumer tech is much more engaging and interactive and enabling. And so I love this. I love the example of Pokemon Go. I don't know if you played Pokemon Go, but this is huge, right? So one of the things about Pokemon Go was it was a completely new use of a device, right? This was augmented reality on people's mobile phones. And so in theory, most of the folks who used it hadn't like read up on augmented reality, didn't have, you know, five minute video snippets to teach them how it worked or some sort of a manual. They simply downloaded the app and started catching all the Pokemon they could. And what allowed that to happen was this really harmonious interaction design with the existing technology and a very obvious interface with engaging and delightful interactions. That's an example of the sort of applications that I expect us to be using even 5 years from now. And so simple little things like you and I both, you know, went through, I don't know, 5 or 6 steps to set up this meeting that we're having. And we did all of those things manually. But what would have been nice is it would have been nice if I had been able to say, hey, Google, please set up the meeting with Dan, and all of the devices and the pieces just would work in the same way that when I give that direction to some item in my home, it works that way. Natural language processing is a big deal. People always prefer to just ask the question and get the help, not an answer, not a 5-step process, but actually have something executed on by just asking for help. And so I think lots more natural language processing, lots more interaction with consumer tech. And then also there are these amazing things in the world of consumer tech that in enterprise tech we're just missing out on. I was thinking about this, a show that my son and I love to watch is by this guy named Random Frank P. And he's a YouTuber who does a setup show. And in this setup show, he just sort of highlights like how people's home computer systems are set up, and it's their gaming systems. And, you know, it's like super techie and nerdy, but he has millions and millions of followers. And these setups are a blend of art and tech. And you see, that's an amazing thing. Because every human being who shows up at work and whom we want to be productive and enabled, they're a blend of those things as well. And so, you know, does it make sense if we want people to be productive to strip out all the artistic things and all the comfortable things and all the interesting and unique things about them and force them to use these standard things? Well, it makes sense if we don't know how to deliver variety. But delivering variety is the task of IT, and then delivering optionality is the task of companies, of all companies going forward. And so as we're now in this mixed hybrid mode of life and work, and we've got, you know, people using enterprise things and using consumer things, I don't think we put that genie back in the bottle very effectively. I just don't. And I will tell you, that's on every level. I'm sitting in a chair that is far more comfortable than my office chair. And when it's time for me to have lunch, sometimes I like to walk downstairs and have cereal, you know? And that sort of mix of things, that is actually enabling, it's empowering, it's positive for us humans. And so I think the future is like that. I think it's a lot more consumer-like, a lot more fun, a lot more, multi-layered and full of variety. And then that gets back to multi-threaded as well. As I look at, you know, how my kids interact with what we old-fashioned folks call video games, these are multi-layered social and achievement platforms that also happen to every now and then, you know, give you a gun and have you shoot someone. But they're so much more advanced. I think our work environments will much more emulate these kinds of tools. And we're already there. I, that's why I say 5 years, you know, 20 years from now, probably the answer should be, you know, quantum computing. But at the moment, it's just a lot more consumer-like.
So you're on the front lines. You get to catalyze some of these changes. What's maybe a technology, specific technology or an initiative that you sponsored either at GoPro or at Nutanix more recently that you feel like is a great source of pride for you?
I love a a series of tools and technologies that we've put together using some third-party tools, but also our own tools. It's a combination of things it would be easy but not accurate to call it a chatbot. But what this is it's an autonomous service agent that helps people in the company get access to anything they need. And we did a lot of research to try to understand how do people want to get help and what do they need? And then we did some work with a bunch of cool companies, a company called MoveWorks, a company called Workato, to try to create the optimal interaction design and the optimal workflow for this thing. And so today what our employees can do is they can, in natural language, ask for anything that IT delivers and be able to get that thing delivered without friction, without visible process, without often even physical interaction. Today, about 85% of our what we call unplanned work, things that we that are requests coming in out of left field or things that break or whatever. About 85% of our unplanned work is handled autonomously by this system. We call it XBot. And what this thing does is it also detects that unplanned work. Simple things like, that VM broke, we're going to restart it. Less simple things like, in a couple of days, your password is going to expire. I'm going to send you a note to change your password, but I'm also going to send you a note to your smartphone, because if you forget to change your password there, that then you can get locked out from your other systems and just little things like that. So today we've got this this growing set of autonomous services that's really, really helping our employees to be more productive. And we measure employee net promoter score, NPS. So not just are we getting the process right, but how do they feel in interacting with us? And our NPS scores are in the 90s, which is unheard of. We have very, very happy employees. And we measure every single time that XBot, this autonomous thing, delivers a service, or that a human being on my team delivers a service, we measure NPS. We measure what it felt like. And we are getting those high scores for both the autonomously delivered and the in-human delivered, the human delivered services. This is really, really exciting, because it frees up the people on my team to focus on those higher level tasks, to do more interesting work. And then also it enables the thousands of employees in the company to be more productive as they do their work. And ultimately, I think that this is a model for all IT departments and for many others as well. The last piece of the story here, the last step of the story, is that as IT began doing this and we became more effective and more efficient and people were happier than ever before, other departments in the company came to us and asked, could you help us to set this exact thing up for us? And so now we offer these services for the HR department, for the legal department, for the facilities department, for the sales operations department, for the developer productivity department. They now are measuring NPS, they're delivering autonomous services, they're using the same tooling, and they're using the same measurements and theory of service delivery internally. And so, as they say, a rising tide raises all ships. And just sort of digging out of the mire of IT KTLO and focusing on employee experience has now allowed other organizations in our company to do the same. And I'm massively proud of that because it's enabling ultimately our employees to work happily and productively. And man, in these times, it's just, it's nice to be able to enjoy not just the work that you do, but the way that you do your work.
And an amazing example of the convergence of consumer tech an enterprise tech, right? Yeah. I mean, that, it feels like, you know, we've talked about bringing Siri or Alexa to work. That's a great example. And NPS in the 90s is unheard of.
It's unheard of. 91 for the last it's five.
Incredible.
Months. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's really phenomenal. Wendy, time's gone by so quickly. We're about out of time. I got to get in one last question for you. Your advice for a younger version of Wendy?
Take better care of your knees. You got to need them.
Too much hiking around Mount Diablo, huh?
No, it was, I had my first kid when I was 40. And I had already like broken my knees, like, you know, and crawling around after a little kid on your knees when you're 40, like I should have, like from day one, I should have wrapped them in bubble wrap. That's all I can tell you.
So in addition to advice about how to break the glass ceiling for my daughters, I should also tell them to protect their knees. Huh? Wear compression, yeah. Compression knee bands.
They are literally like the most useful thing as you get older.
Well, that's wrapping up a very eclectic discussion. Good advice. Wendy, this has been such a pleasure. I hope that maybe as some of these trends that we've been discussing come to fruition, maybe we'll have you back for another session. How would that be?
I would love that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I've really enjoyed this and hope that everyone listening did as well. This is Dan Turchin, your host of AI and the Future of Work, signing off. Back next week with another fascinating guest.